Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Week's end. It's the 8th day of November 2013. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go for the newly refurbished chat room. Thanks, Lottie. Thanks, Sparky. And that's also where you go for the listen live stream. That's where you go if you want to help us keep this all the plates spinning on the little sticks in the air. The PayPal button is at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. So, too, is the traditional mail address. That traditional mail address being the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEY, WV 25801. Remember, checks and money orders should not be made to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid does not see the checks nor the money orders, as everything goes to pay the bills. So there's that. Either way is fine. Any help you can give is appreciated. We are, we try to raise $150 every evening. And in point of fact, we are still in a little bit of a hole, even after Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge last night. So, we closed the week to the good at $300 this evening. So that's where that stands. 30 at 10. Oh, God, I can't even. It's Friday. I'm past math at this point in time. Thanks, Ed. Ed just got us started this evening. It is it's very, very kind. Appreciated. We are $25 down the road. Thank you very kindly, Ed. Thank you, Jeremy. Stream sounds good from my PC tonight. Wonderful. I hope that's nothing novel, but thanks very much. Loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac, Bob. Thanks, Randy. You know, it's good to have a little backup here because it's hard to monitor otherwise from here in the studio, that is. So here it is, Friday on the front porch on the Horn. You know, no holds barred. Of course, I don't know of any holds that we bar through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday either, but it's a little bit different on Friday on the front porch insofar as we bring on an entire round table. You know, there's a Galahad, a Sir Mix-a-Lot, and a Sir Lanciliate, and right, yeah. And there's some late, right. I'm not going to get myself in trouble. We do this whole group conversation thing. And we'll get that started here in a little bit. And if you would like to be part of it, via the traditional telephone lines, we've got four places based on the technology that we have here. We've got four slots that can be filled by traditional telephony, that number 304-658-3333. And then there's always the ever wonderful Horn Molloy Skype chat group. And if you want to be part of that, let me know, and I'll pass your contact information over to Duncan, the long-suffering host of that chat group, and he'll add you in. Otherwise, we say we'll pull together the usual suspects, but we never necessarily know who the usual suspects are. Oh, very funny, Lottie, in the chat room. Sounds like we're going to have a D&D game. Yeah, I got my 29-sided. Let's see, all the switches thrown? Good. Yeah. Don't confuse me. all the switches are indeed thrown, including the third switch. Lottie says, I'm a third-level wizard with flaming hands. All right, so where do we start this evening? I mentioned a story last night that Kim in New York had sent along that I didn't get to because I said it deserved entirely too much time. And yeah, there's news out there. There's news o'plenty. Things like a proposed deal to keep from blasting Iran into the middle of last century. Or the follow-up to Typhoon Haiyan, which was awful. 195-mile-an-hour winds, apparently. And a death toll that is expected to rise. And, of course, there's no such thing as global climate change, no such thing as global warming, because the American Petroleum Institute says there's not, and, well, we always know we can trust them. So, yeah, there's plenty of news out there, but I don't get a lot of joy out of just talking about the same thing everybody else is talking about. I like the little stories, and you know, maybe other people, I don't know, I don't have enough time to listen to everything I'd like to listen to. Maybe other people are talking about it too, but anyway, this story comes from Mother Jones by Sarah Posner. And Kim in New York City sent it along. You can... It's... Well, he's back! Apparently, Dim Leader has come out of his spider hole. Former Dim Leader has come out of his spider hole to start speechifying again. You remember way, 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 way back when we were busy slaughtering the otherwise largely defenseless and blameless people of Iraq, and George W. Dimwit was caught on an open mic saying something to the effect, he was in Jerusalem, and it was something to the effect of, well, God told me to attack Saddam, and I did, and look at that, and now God's telling me to bring peace to the Palestinians and the Israelis, and, well, you gotta let me do that, or some such drivel. Remember that? Meanwhile, during the entire presidency of George W. Dimwit, the Middle East just continued to get worse and worse and worse because we don't want to engage in nation building. Well, like I said, he's up and out of his spider hole, George W. Bush is, unindicted co-conspirator in an entire panoply of war crimes. Next week, he's heading off to Irving, Texas, to deliver the keynote speech for an organization called the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute. What is the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute? Well, you may recall that in the email last night, Kim said, "Even as a non-religious Jew, I find this deeply frustrating." Perhaps was the word, or maybe the word was infuriating, because Barbara Bush's son is, well, he really is, isn't he? Is going to go and speechify and help fundraise for an organization, the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute, who describes their mission as, quote, to educate Christians in their role to provoke, educate Christians in their role to provoke the Jewish people to jealousy and thus save some of them, Romans, can't tell if that's a four or a speck on the monitor, Romans 11, 11 through 14. Romans being the great... Romans is to St. Paul what Magical Mystery Tour was to the Beatles. It's Romans is the dark side of the moon of the Pauline letters. I mean, just one long hallucination. Meditations on insanity, one might think of it. The Messianic Jewish Bible Institute has Bible schools in 12 countries. They've got an online hustle in Messianic theology. They've got programs to train Messianic rabbis and pastors. Messianic. What is all this? And Irish Dave took the words right out of my mouth. Bob, Messianic Jew is just another name for Jews for Jesus. I knew I'd seen the word infuriating somewhere. It's actually in Ms. Posner's article. After publication of the article, she notes Rabbi David Wolpe of Los Angeles' Sinai Temple, whom Newsweek has called the most influential rabbi in the country, tweeted, "This is infuriating." What is infuriating? This is. Well, the fact that George W. Bush is going to go and do the money hustle for this outfit whose goal is to restore Israel and the Jews and bring about the second coming of Christ.
Huh? What, Edith?
Yeah. They're going to compel Jebus to get on his holy rolls and come down out of the clouds in a mighty thunderclap of glory. Oh, never mind. Ms. Posner reports that David Saperstein, the director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, said, "It's disappointing that he would give his stamp of approval to a group whose program is an express effort to convert Jews and not to accept the validity of the Jewish covenant." In other words, it's a pity that he's lending the stamp of his authority to a group who doesn't know how to mind their own business. What's next? Is he going to go and speak at Muslims for Jesus? How about Hindus for Jesus? Or I don't know, maybe there's a Jesistic Hindu outfit that celebrates Diwali at, oh dear God, we were there last night. It's coming up on November the 14th, next Thursday. And he's going to, former dim leader, is going to discuss his White House experiences. It's sort of the ex-presidential, not too bright, what I did on my summer vacation kind of shtick. But if you don't find any of this sickening enough, get the basket. The bucket. Ticket packages range from $100 to $100,000, including 20 invitations to a VIP reception and photo opportunity with Bush, 10 signed copies of Bush's book Decision Points. You know, those are not real difficult to come by, at least the unsigned versions. You can find them at Dollar General and Family Dollar and Dollar Tree, and yeah, because they were bought by the crate. That's why they've got that little dagger symbol. That's the way it is with most right-wing books. They get that little dagger symbol for bought in bulk. Oh, and goody, there will be free passes to tour the George W. Bush Presidential Library and Comic Book Compendium. interestingly, the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute would not answer the question Ms. Posner put to them, to wit, was George W. Bush being paid to do this? Because, you know, after they're done with being president, Bushes don't step out the front door without a check having already cleared. You know who last year's keynote speaker was? The Beckerhead. At last year's event, he said, I'm sorry. Last year he got the Defender of Israel Award. Good God. And in so doing, said, one of the reasons why I love Israel so much is I'm a guy who's for the underdog. I'm a Mormon, which is kind of the Jew of the Christian world. Really? At best, I would think he would be like the Jew of Kolob if he's the... Oh, dear. No. This is just horrifying. I love this paragraph toward the end of the article. The penultimate paragraph, as a matter of fact. Another MJBI board member, Rabbi Marty Waldman of Baruch Hashem, a Messianic congregation in Dallas, described his own conversion experience before making a pitch to the audience to donate money to MJBI. Money, he explained, is needed to hasten the return of Jesus. With the funds it collects, Waldman said, MJBI trains, quote, people to preach the good news of the Messiah to the Jewish people. That's important, Waldman noted, because when there are enough Jewish people who call Jesus their Savior, quote, some sort of a trigger will go off in heaven. Oh my God, there's a gun to Yeshua's head in heaven? And our Father in heaven will say, okay, son, it's time to go get your bride. Well, how many creepy images can we work into one paragraph? So, Yeshua, who in life, such as it is understood, was a 30-year-old guy who never married in a society that thought it was really weird to be 30 and unmarried, has to have his old daddy put a gun to his head to make him go claim his bride. Anybody's gaydar going off? Because mine is. I mean, like, sweat condition alpha. You're marrying Princess Lookie. She's got huge tracts of land. Oh, God. So we now know, in case we ever wondered, that George W. Bush will go anywhere and say anything to anybody as long as the check clears. Because he ain't doing this for free. You know he's not. Let's see, who else has spoken there? Rick Santor... No, that was a different Messianic Jewish organization. The Messianic Jewish Alliance of America. Splitters! Yeah, this is repulsive. And I can't get to provoke the Jewish people. Listen, you got a prime minister in Israel who's ready to nuke Iran if some Iranian brings him a cold cup of coffee. Let's not do any more provoking, please. Ugh. So, there's that. And Ron and Raleigh. Oh, I've got it, Bob. It's a backdoor way for our Jewish brothers and sisters to have Christmas. Help! And this, somewhat cryptically from Jim, Gaydar? Boom! Irish Dave noting, I don't have to tell you on Kolob, they don't need no stinking gun laws. No, they don't. But Kate, just noting, just heard on CBC that a train carrying crude from North Dakota derailed in Alabama. No word of where, but they're going to let it burn out. Climate? What climate? Kate noting, yikes. All right, now my curiosity is piqued. Oh, there it is. Let's see, who do I trust? All right. Huffington Post, Yahoo, or Bloomberg. There's a choice. And this is a kind of a tough segue, but what the hell? A train carrying North Dakota crude to the Gulf Coast derailed in rural Alabama, touching off rail car fires that will be allowed to burn themselves out. Well, you know, I mean, it's the little engine that could. It's a couple of tankers. What the, you know, wrong. Part of the 90-car, three-locomotive unit train derailed shortly before 1 a.m. local time, said a spokesman for Genesee and Wyoming, Inc., which owns the Alabama and Gulf Coast Railway. 11 cars were believed to be on fire, and emergency crews decided to let them burn. So we have gone from drill, baby, drill to burn, baby, burn. The train was en route from Amory, Mississippi to Walnut Hill, Florida. It was carrying sweet North Dakota crude. Hartley said by phone, Don Hartley, that is, regional Alabama emergency management official, I would imagine the line is going to be closed for a couple of days at least. Why are they going to let it burn out? Just burn all that oil? Just send all that carbon up into the atmosphere? Granted, it's only 11 tanker cars full, but at this point in time, every little bit doesn't help. Why? Because it's Alabama, Stan. What's this here FAR department y'all keep talking about? Wouldn't you have to pay tax? I don't see nothing here says the Wyoming and Genesee Cream Ale Railroad ever paid us any money for any FAR department services. I mean, sure, what the hell? It's just like when you're all excited and spring's just coming. You can get out in the yard for the first time and start that first barbecue, and you got a goddamn ziggurat of charcoal briquettes on your Weber, and you go and you just do the happy dance with the Gulf Light around the briquettes, and you get them really good and saturated. You want to really succeed, and you throw the match on it, and kaboom, and the windows shake, and the cloud goes up, and That's just all it is. This is interesting, however, because the train was to deliver crude to Genesis Energy LP's terminal in Walnut Hill, Florida. Terminal. What's it going to do once it gets to the terminal? Because terminal means end. Is it going to get in another pipeline? Is it going to go to a refinery? Is it going to help lower American per-gallon gas prices? No. This was just a brief interlude in the rest of the... journey. He was accused of having burnt down the old courthouse, which was just as likely to have been done by... it was originally burnt down by Union troops. They rebuilt it, and then they accused Henry Wells of burning it down. And to protect him, allegedly, against the lynch mob, they put him up in the attic garret of the Pickens County Courthouse. At which point, a lynch mob gathered below, even though there was threatening signs of a big-ass thunderstorm. Tornadoes tend to roll through Pickens County, and F3 hit there a few years back and just slobber-knocked it. But lynch mobs aren't known for being the brightest bulbs in the socket. So So as they were standing there hollering, you know, we want to, yeah, right. Lightning is said to have stricken the window, killing Henry Wells, and forever imprinting his face, which looks like something out of crude early 20th century minstrelsy, into the glass. They claim that the glass has been replaced, but the face always comes back. My theremin imitation. I've always suspected that this was a cheap cover-up for the fact that they just murdered him outright. But that's where the train derailed, Pickens County, Alabama, where there's at least one photograph of a huge cloud of oily black smoke billowing into the air. Time out. Check. We're going to let this burn out because it's really good to have oily black smoke billowing into the air for the 19,746 residents of Pickens County to breathe. Do I got that right? The AL.com story with a little more detail to it. Three train cars have exploded. At least a dozen others have been damaged, burned, or both, after some cars on a train traveling through Aliceville and Pickens County derailed and the crude oil inside them ignited late Thursday night. That was last night. One family who lived near the site was evacuated early Friday morning as a precautionary measure, but they've since been allowed to return to their home because, well, hell, that ain't nothing bad. I mean, that burning oil smoke ain't nothing to it. It's just smoke. But the story gets better. 20 of the 90 rail cars, along with 2 of the 3 locomotives derailed. Okay, worse. It gets worse. 11 rail cars caught fire, and it was because of dangers to the responders and the difficulty they would face getting to the rail cars that they decided, oh, hell, we'll just let it burn out. And they're still waiting for that to happen. By the way, it happened near a, because these things still exist in places like Alabamistan, because, well, job-killing regulations. It happened near a trestle over a bog, and the trestle was made of wood. And hey, the trestle caught fire too. So some of that goo is going into that bog, which many of us recognize, and this is probably one of those snotty intellectual elitist words, a wetland where animals live. The Tuscaloosa Fire Department Hazardous Materials Team was deployed to the scene of the accident early Friday morning anyway to ensure leaking... I love the anyway there. To ensure leaking crude oil does not contaminate the nearby environment. But there's a 2 paragraphs up we're told that you can't get firefighters anywhere near the damn thing because it's so hot and dangerous. Hey, Eustace, any of that oil getting anywhere near that environment over there? Not that I can tell, but hell, it's a half mile away, boss. Bog. Well, that's what we call them. We call them bogs. That way, when we call them bogs, we don't get caught up in all that job-killing federal bureaucracy of having to call it a wetland, and the next thing you know, you can't crash no goddamn oil car trains on it. And then this is choice. Michael Williams is a representative for Genesee and Wyoming Inc. He said a derailment cleanup contractor is on standby and will begin cleaning up the wreckage as soon as it is safe to do so. A cleanup contractor. Because, of course, Genesee and Wyoming cannot be bothered to have their own cleanup crews for their own oil spills. No, you've got to have a contractor for that. And they're on standby, and they might get around to getting down there just as quick as they get done negotiating the price. And the check clears. Yeah, see, Jim's in the spirit of the discussion here. Oh, hell, Bob, what's a little petrochemical release between folks and where they and other critters live? Right? Right, Jim. Oh, yeah, you're there. Yeah, Randy caught the melted the trestle part. Well, it didn't really melt the trestle, Randy. It torched the trestle. Because remember, those trestles are made out of treated wood. And it makes it go up real, real fiery-like. So, just another day on the planet here where global climate change is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated against mankind. Wow. Oh, by the way, and here's how my brain works. That line about the greatest hoax was, of course, coined by Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, and he's a senator from Oklahoma, and the junior senator from Oklahoma is a guy named Tom Coburn, who is retiring this year. Don't celebrate. The people of Oklahoma stand will find somebody even nuttier than him. Remember, Tom Coburn was carried into the Senate on a wave of citizen concern over what Tom Coburn said was a rash, a veritable epidemic of lesbianism taking place in Oklahoma junior high schools. Yeah. No, really, that'll get you elected to the Senate in Oklahoma, Stan. And Tom Coburn's retiring, and he just recently announced that he is in his fourth bout with cancer. He's got prostate cancer. It's not given as the reason for his retirement, but no, he's got and so I couldn't help but think this man who voted or said he would like to vote or did vote and swears up and down that Obamacare is killing America. This guy has health care that other people in this country are dying for, literally. But he's beaten cancer three times, and he may well beat it four because of that health care. Meanwhile, people out there, well, you might be thinking you got some prostate problems, but you don't have any health insurance coverage, and not a damn lot you can do about it. Or maybe the one day that she's showering before work and she feels that lump in her breast, and well, that's scary as hell. But she doesn't have any health insurance either. So we'll just hope that it's a benign cyst, okay? Yeah, great. Yeah, that right. Right. And you over there getting up three times to go wee-wee in the middle of the night, well, you're just going to drink some tomato juice and because they say that's good for the prostate, and okay? Because remember, we're not having any Medicaid expansion in Oklahoma, Stan, because, you know, Jesus and conservatism and freedom and Wolverines! Yeah, Jim's dialed in this evening. Oh, yeah, the smell of burning creosote smells like victory. Mmm. That was the one. Yeah, because those wooden trestles, that's creosoted stuff. Yes, it is. So it's just another day in Oklahoma, another day in Alabama. But speaking of the oil industry, which we sort of were, our buddy Texas T in the chat room just reminded me of a story that he had sent to me on the Facebook. This one really does bear mentioning. It comes from the website Freakout Nation. Anomaly writing, it's been over 3 years since the Deepwater Horizon disaster, which took the lives of 11 men and resulted in the largest oil spill in American history, and it's still taking its toll. Down to Auburn University, that's in Alabama, Stan, by the way, the Auburn. Okay, all kidding aside, we'll put aside the whole Alabama-Auburn thing for a little bit and treat this with the seriousness that it deserves. There's a professor of aquatic microbiology by the name of Dr. Kova Arias. Dr. Arias, in conjunction with being a professor of aquatic microbiology, researches, in particular, a wee tiny microscopic critter called Vibrio vulnificus. I know, it sounds like a Star Trek character. It isn't. Well, maybe it's a Star Trek monster. Among other things, Dr. Kova Arias is not on the Christmas card list for British Petroleum. Remember, what was it? What was the dude's name that wanted to get his life back after the... Yeah, that British Petroleum. Because Dr. Arias has researched, among other things, what happens when Vibrio vulnificus gets hold of the oyster beds. And you might recall that not much of an oyster industry down there in the Gulf anymore. Of course, that's not to say that BP isn't running their ads. Oh, it's better in Alabama. Nah. Better over here in New Orleans. Nuh-uh, Mississippi. That BP. And because scientists are a curious lot, Dr. Arias expanded research out beyond oysters. Here's the audio of a report from WKRG-TV5. I think you'll find it interesting, to say the least. In a minute. I mean, they gotta make money, right? WKRG-TV5. Here we go.
This week, News 5 investigates, are tar balls from the 2010 oil spill a risk for Vibrio vulnificus, a flesh-eating bacteria that infects about 5 people a year in
Alabama? No, don't do that. I'm proud to say that I did say it right. The audio apparently doesn't want to run. But no. The upshot is that it turns out that not only did Vibrio vulnificus put a hurtin' on the oyster population, it's in the tarballs. Curiously, the tarballs wash up on the beach. Interestingly, the beach is a big source of tourist revenue for places like the Florida Panhandle, Alabama, Mississippi. Yeah, them too. Well, big deal. It's a bacterium, right? No. Vibrio vulnificus is a really creepy, this is why I said it might be a Star Trek monster, flesh-eating bacteria. When using the singular, we should use U-M at the end of the Latinate word. It is a flesh-eating bacterium. But being a bacterium, it tends to congregate with lots of others of its kith and kin, and we refer to them as bacteria, a few of whom can start chewing away at your hide. And it's real damned hard to kill. Charming, huh? Yeah, way cool. Meanwhile, somewhere back in the United Kingdom, the former head of BP has gotten his life back, while folks on the Gulf Coast are wondering whether or not they're going to be bit players, you know, red shirts, in a morality play about flesh-eating bacteria. Yeah. So, yeah, that's very real. And don't take home any tar balls. Then again, don't. Well, see, this grieves me. Because hereabouts where I live, when people say, we're going to the beach, they mean Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, to which I have never been. I hear it's lovely. But when I hear the word beach, the thing that happens in my mind is I think of Lower Alabama and those pristine white sand beaches that extend all the way from Florida across Alabama and over into Mississippi. My favorite little roadhouse is there. The Floribama Lounge, where you can go back and forth and drink in Florida and drink in Alabama and back. Yeah, that, sure, why not? Fun. A Mr. Buffet has been known to frequent the joint from time to time. So once upon a time did a fellow by the name of M. Jagger. Well-known little place. Even got the T-shirt. And while nobody particularly wants to report on it, except for folks like Dar Jamal, who is reporting magnificently on it, and while BP is paying scientists to say, nuh-uh, everything's fine down here in Mississippi, Dr. Arias is out there, this is interesting. Little critters that wiped out the oysters are in the tar balls now. It almost looks like a delivery vector. How about that? So, you get the idea. And since we wandered off over into train derailments and burning oil and Vibrio vulnificus, and well, let's head out west for a minute. For a couple of different reasons. Over at Grist, John Upton is reporting on an interesting new phenomenon, and that is the crowdfunding of science. Like, you know, Kickstarter, Indiegogo, and I guess there's a million other of them now. Because the United States has we got a deficit. Yeah, we got to kill the Social Security in order to save it. Because of that, scientists are not able to come up with the money that they desperately need in order to be able to do the science that they trained and learned to. Yeah. So now they're crowdfunding it. They're creating programs in which they describe what their research goals are, and they're putting it out there in the wider world to try to get enough money to get the job done. Enter a scientist in the Great Northwest by the name of Professor Dan Jaffe at the University of Washington Atmospheric Sciences Department. They crowdfunded, and largely probably because the Friends of Coal, the American Clean Coal, yada, 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 Forum Energy, whatever, think PAC, buys off so many research institutions, e.g., Virginia Polytechnic Institute. You want to do this stuff, you got to find some way to pay for it. So it was crowdsourced. Here's what, as of this past Monday, Dr. Jaffe says. These are preliminary findings of the research. It's still under peer review. But because it was crowdsourced, Dr. Jaffe felt like he was had a moral obligation to tell folks what he'd found out. Well, what was he studying, Bob? He was studying something that has become more and more increasingly important when we try to understand why it is that people who have to live near coal get so godforsaken sick. Dust. Or as particulate matter. Dr. Jaffe found out that, as is reported at Grist, in Mr. Upton's report, coal dust is blowing off rail cars and over neighborhoods located near train tracks that are used to haul coal in the Pacific Northwest. Oh, Kate, this affects you too. Hi, Kate. Air monitors placed near the tracks in a Seattle residential area. This isn't out in the boonies. Does Washington State even have boonies? Well, okay, east of the mountains, yes, they have boonies. Air monitors placed near the tracks in a Seattle residential area detected spikes in large particles of pollution when coal-hauling cars chugged by. By the way, just as a reminder, down there in Pickens County, Alabama, Stan, where the coal trains are, see how easy it is? Where the oil tankers are just being allowed to burn out. Somebody get the marshmallows and the weenies! I mean, we can't get close to it yet, but once it dies down, let's have a barbecue. As long as none of that oil's getting into that environment over there. The rest of this, that ain't environment. That, right there, that there ball got some environment. But no, those oil fires also have massive amounts of particulate matter. And smoke is not like some sort of inert gas. It's not going to just dissipate. It's going to fall out. And when it falls out, because it is burning oil, it's going to create leave behind these nasty, 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 vile, filthy things called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Aromatic? You mean like, eucalyptus? Smells so nice and stuff? And koalas eat it? No. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are a laundry list of cancer-causing chemicals. They get in the soil, they get in the air, and look, they get in your children. Same thing with coal dust. Poison. Ultrafines. Less than 2.5 microns in size. Goes into your... All over you. We've talked about this. So, as a result of Dr. Jaffe's testing, they found out that air monitors placed near the tracks in a Seattle residential area detected spikes in large particles of pollution, not ultrafines, but large particles, when coal-hauling cars chugged by. Trust me, you don't want to breathe the large particles either. They also picked up an increase in diesel particulate matter. Hey, really, diesel? Guess what one of the biggest sources of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons is? I'll be damned, diesel fuel. Son of a... They also picked up an increase in diesel. These preliminary research findings suggest that plans to increase the amount of coal hauled from mines in Montana... No, really, Kate, turn off the CBC now. I'm done talking about religion. And Wyoming to propose new shipping terminals in Washington and Oregon will worsen air pollution. No. No. Oh, furniture kicking. Let's rewrite that. These preliminary research findings suggest that plans to increase the amount of coal hauled from mines in Montana and Wyoming to proposed new shipping terminals in Washington and Oregon will kill people! Yeah. Meanwhile, the standard response from the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway Company. Well, how is the research being done? How is it being funded? What standards are in place? Who is involved in that? So, crowdfunding is a really new concept when it comes to scientific research. Which can be translated into the shorter version as, we didn't pay this man anything. Why is he opening his fool mouth? We're in charge of the science here, by damn it. They raised something like, a little in excess of 20 grand from 271 people. 271 people donated a little more than $20,000 to help purchase air monitors and pay for labor for the researchers and a technician laboring in some laboratory with one flickering fluorescent bulb in the ceiling because, well, Burlington. Well, by God, there won't be any more Burlington Northern Santa Fe money going to the University of Washington. I can tell you that! Because that's the way these thugs operate. We have nowhere. Crowdsourced science? There's no way to suggest that this could. And see, it's. The research is being peer reviewed. It will be peer reviewed. It's okay. It'll be published. But the line of attack will be. And I know this because we've heard this here before with regard to the. All the scientific research that's been done that points to the fact that mountaintop removal kills people. Hi, by the way, I'm Bob. Have I reminded you to go to www.acheac.org lately? Please do. For instance, the birth defect research, you might recall that the industry front group, the National Mining Association, and their paid hack-flack piece-of-shit lawyers, Crowell Mooring, issued a press release that said, in essence, well, of course hillbillies have birth defects. They commit incest, don't they, those hillbillies? Well, that study didn't even take into account the fact that hillbillies commit incest. Therefore, the study is invalid. Expect more of the same. And do we realize that when a professor like Dan Jaffe or people that I know and respect, folks like Dr. Michael Hendricks, Dr. Michael McCauley, do we understand what a heroic act it is when they simply publish results of the scientific inquiries they make here in 21st century corporatized Ayn Rand Wonderland America? Because those are heroic acts. It is heroic. I wish it wasn't, but it is. It is heroic when scientists speak up by merely publishing the results of their inquiries. If those inquiries can be deemed deleterious to the quarterly profit and loss statements of pissants like Burlington Northern Santa Fe or CSX or Alpha Natural Resources or Peabody or Arch or, didn't we talk about this last Monday? Murray Energy. Professor Jaffe said, I've published over 120 papers in the scientific peer-reviewed literature. I know the drill. If I didn't feel our results would hold up to peer review and scrutiny, there's no way I'd be releasing them now. Burlington Northern Santa Fe spokes creep unidentified. How I said,
how's it being done? What standards are in place? We didn't give them any standards, therefore they can't possibly be appropriate standards. We'll tell you which standards you need to follow.
So that's the beginning. That's tonight's filibobster on this Friday on the Front Porch edition of the Horn. And I'll check in with. If you want to get in, whether you want to participate in Friday on the Front Porch or whether you want to participate solo, it's fine by me. Either way, jump right in. (304-658-3333) is the direct dial line for traditional telephones. Or if you want to join via Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Thanks very much to Ed for getting us started this evening. Thus far, he's all by himself. Trying to raise somewhere between $150 and $300 this evening. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So too the traditional mail address. We call what we do here Conversation Radio, and you know why. You're about to find out why if you don't. It's Friday on the Front Porch, and this is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. seemed more than a little bit appropriate. Classic track from Blackfoot from way back when. Train from the album Strikes. This is The Horn, Friday on the Front Porch. Let's see, a little bit of here, a little bit of there. Lines open, 304-658-3333 to jump in on Friday on the Front Porch. And I've gotten to Friday on the Front Porch a little bit late the last couple of Fridays, but not this week. We're jumping in. We got two rocking hours of Friday on the Front Porch coming our way. Quick note before we go out onto the porch. Quick note from our buddy Robert in Australia. Subject line, you may have to call us Australia Stan. Hi, Bob. Our current Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, said in 2009 that global warming is crap. Those were his actual words. And, of course, the second he was sworn in as Prime Minister, he shut down the Climate Commission. Well, you know, if you don't believe in something, it's kind of silly to have a commission to... I mean, it's like a Santa Claus commission to Tony Abbott, right? And now our previous liberal PM, John Howard, and by liberal we in Australia, because, you know, it's like water in the toilet goes different directions between the northern and southern hemisphere. Because former liberal PM means former right-wing conservative weirdo PM, John Howard has stated that, I am opposed to putting a ludicrously heavy financial burden on poorer people. By the way, Robert notes, John Howard was quite happy to introduce the GST, the Goods and Services Tax, a totally regressive tax that put a greater tax burden on poorer people. You know, so poor. Thank you, Wolf Blitzer. I am opposed to putting a ludicrously heavy financial burden on poorer people in the community in the name of shifting to renewables when I am unconvinced that catastrophe is around the corner. Do you define around the corner as the Philippines relative to Australia? Because that was a whopping great big load of 195-mile-per-hour climate catastrophe that slammed it. Yeah. When it is affordable and makes economic and political sense to do so, of course, you should use renewables. I'm not opposed to using renewables. He said nuclear power, shale oil, and gas from fracking were the solutions to the world's energy needs. Oil and gas from shale has brought about a dramatic reduction in greenhouse gases in the United States. No, it hasn't. I'm in favor of the use of nuclear power, he said. How about we build the reactor right next to your house, Mr. Howard? Mr. Howard's comments came ahead of a speech he is set to deliver at the Global Warming Policy Foundation in London. How did he even get an invitation? The foundation... Oh, wait a minute. The foundation is a think tank established by Nigel Lawson, a former British Chancellor of the Exchequer, one of the UK's most prominent climate change skeptics. So the Global Warming Policy Foundation of London is actually the Global Warming Denial Policy Foundation. No, Global Warming Denial Hack Foundation in London. Robert closes saying, oh dear, my brain hurts. Just call us Australia Stan from now on. I don't have it in my heart to do that, Robert. I just don't. I don't. I swear I don't. Okay, Friday on the Front Porch begins. Front Porch roll call.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Duncan.
Hey, Bob. Greg.
Hey, Greg.
I don't know about Sergi. Larry was muted.
Okay. Hi, Sergi and Larry. You'll be along. All right. Let's check in on the regular telephone lines. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Yeah, grouchy old man.
Hey, grouchy. Yeah. What's happening, Bill? I thought, hey, maybe he'll enjoy that little harp solo there on the song.
Man, who the hell was that?
That's an old southern rock band called Blackfoot out of Jacksonville, Florida.
I don't remember Blackfoot, but I don't remember anybody playing like that.
Yeah, that's a respectable little blast, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. See if you can dig up Butterfield's version of that off his first album, but that was much heavier than one you played. Paul and those guys were still, you know, a little tied to Chicago, you know.
Right. Right, right.
That was kick-ass. That guy was good.
Let's see who else we got here. Hey, welcome to the program.
You got me here, Colorado Springs.
All right, we got Kevin. All right,
can you hear me?
I got you good. You hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm on a different phone.
Okay. Yeah, audio's a little dodgy, but I think we'll be okay. And let's see, line three.
Switch.
Who we got? Line three. Anybody?
Hello?
Ah, there's Jim.
Good evening.
How are you?
All right. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. That weird audio thing's happening. Hopefully it'll settle down, though.
Yeah, I lost you at one point.
Okay. Well, I think we've got everybody here. Welcome to the front porch. You know the rules. Kick your boot, put your boots up on the porch rail. Get a swig out of the old earthenware jug, or sweet tea, lemonade. This time of year, in some parts of the world, hot chocolate, what have you. What's happening?
I'm still getting mine out of the cooler.
Oh, there's a cooler involved. That's always good news.
I just put ice in it.
Yeah, you're talking about that train. The thing that came back to me was the one big bio of Truman that sold heavily in the 80s and 90s, and they described the number of miles of railroad in 1946, because, Harry had a run-in with the engineers in those days because they had worked for nothing since 41, And the amount of rail miles was so amazing, because now every time you turn around, there's one blowing up somewhere.
Well, I think part of this has to do with the fact that they're going to overload. Okay, this is the paranoid part of the program, guys. I think they're going to overwork the rail infrastructure, and we'll have a few more of these just as a way of convincing us that we really, really need the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like when the guys with the dark suits and the white on white ties look at you and say, it'd be a shame if anything happened to your kid. Yeah, that's a mighty nice bog you got down there in Alabama. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it.
Yeah, I was just wondering what other people's opinions were of the... Because, these guys don't seem to give a shit what blows up or what happens.
Well, look, when a 90-car tanker has 11 cars that go to Jesus, here's the fun part. One... They don't even have to maintain their own crew to go clean up their own mess. We've got a contractor on standby. I mean, if they ever sober up, one. Two, the boys up in accounting, that's 11 cars, and that's how many, and that's that many gallons, and this many work hours, and the cleanup's going to cost this, and the contractor, the cleanup contracting. Man, this is a sweet, and they get to write it all off on their taxes. Cost of doing business.
The use of these subcontractors in almost every line of work today is a big racket.
Absolutely.
It isn't just my imagination. I don't know what the other fellows think, but every time you turn around, they can use a subcontractor who can go out and hire somebody cheap, not take any care of any medical benefits. All the things that were good about being an industrial worker, if there was anything good about it, maybe I'm talking like a northern guy who's seen more unions,
No, I think you're talking about a guy who understands how America used to work, Bill.
Yeah. Well,
if we're talking about rails, out here, Union Pacific does all their maintenance. I see their trucks going up and down the tracks all the time, they drive onto the crossing and put their little things down, and they go zooming up the tracks.
Yeah, you got to think those trucks are fun, don't you, Duncan? The ones with the actual
wheels. Yeah, because you can just sit there and just hit the accelerator and look at the track. I mean, the thing's going to drive itself, basically.
It beats the hell out of the old movie things where there was some guy pumping, huh? Yeah.
Trucks on the railroad tracks?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you've never seen those?
I've seen, Fort Worth is a big freight rail hub, and I've seen people in trucks, like Chevys, driving along, adjacent to the rails.
No. This is the same Chevy truck, but it's got a set of railroad wheels.
And it lifts the whole truck up when you get on the rails, and the tires are off the ground, and it's got drive wheels on the rails now.
Yeah,
I have never seen one of those before in my life. I see a lot of Union Pacific workers, but they're all driving adjacent to on that little grassy area.
Well, let's put it this way: from a redneck perspective, Sergi, it gives a whole new meaning to lift kit.
I'll see if I can find a picture of one.
Oh well.
Hey, Jim, I take it my reference to Myrtle Beach didn't go over? Tacky, 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 you say?
Well, yeah, in my opinion. I mean, good Lord in heaven, that's just like the tackiest place I've ever seen in my life. And why anybody would want to go there, I don't know, because it's just loaded with all kinds of, you know, just crappy hotels and never did anything for me.
Jim, it's the Hillbilly Riviera.
Well, we never went there. We either went to Holden or Litchfield when I was a kid. The only time I ever went to Myrtle Beach was when, like, we used to have our high school graduation thing, and everybody would go in there and get drunk as a lord and do whatever they wanted to do, and I don't know how many people would come back pregnant, but that's about it. You know, it was just, it never appealed to me, actually, and I can remember when I was working at Fort Jackson, these guys who'd want to have an off-site meeting, they would always pick out Myrtle Beach because of one spot, and that was because it was called the Dollhouse.
Strip joint, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it was Bill who mentioned the other night that film with the Cappuccini and Lawrence Harvey and Barbara Stanwyck. Good Lord. My mind is going, come on, Bill, help me out. What's the name of that film? Walk on the Wild Side.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they had a whorehouse in there with Barbara Stanwyck in New Orleans called the Dollhouse. So
yeah,
I guess
that was New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah, so well, they had a dollhouse in Myrtle Beach, and all these guys would go down there and get away from their wives. And I'd have to
Behave like heathens?
Yeah, well, of course, I was never invited to go with them. I mean, you know, I just basically wasn't one of the boys because when I went off-site to do stuff like that and do workshops and things, I stayed in my room and I did my work and stuff like that while they were going off to the dollhouse, and they would all come back the next morning and talk about, you know.
Oh, you mean with the the three packs of Chesterfields at the strip joint growl?
You got it, and they were all, you know, just going on about this, that, and the other. And none of those guys, no woman who had any self-respect or sense of decency about her for any amount of money would even allow them to light her cigarette, you know? So it was just basically a big strip joint, and I think they probably had a room in the back where you could get a lap dance or whatever.
Yeah, my beach experiences down that way are confined to Hilton Head and Kiawah.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's the place to go. And I remember when I was a cadet at Citadel, John Carl West was the lieutenant governor and governor of the state, and he would invite all the guys from Camden, my hometown, to go to Kiawah for an oyster roast and stuff like that. Of course, that's Kiawah before the Arabs bought it up.
Well, before it became a glorified excuse for a golf course. Hey Jim, I'm glad you mentioned the Citadel, because it reminded me of something I wanted to mention to you.
Oh boy!
Your old classmate Pat Conroy has a new book out.
I've heard that. I don't even know what the title of it is.
The title is Santini is Dead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess this is the sequel to the Great Santini, the book he wrote about his father.
I don't know, but I hope to get my hands on it at some point in time.
Yeah, Pat's a good writer, but I'll tell you one book you need to read. You need to read The Lords of This.
Oh, I have.
And that'll give you a good example about the...
I think I've read just about everything he wrote. The Water is Wide.
Uh-huh.
The Boo. Great Santini, Lords of Discipline. What's the one that they made the movie out of with Nick Nolte and Barbara Streisand?
I know what you're talking about, but I can't pull it to mind.
Prince of Tides.
Yeah, Prince of Tides. But I'll tell you, the Boo was a real character.
Yeah, yeah.
Lieutenant Colonel Nugent Cavorsi, he was the assistant commandant of cadets there. And I can guarantee you, in his salad days, that you could be standing at one end of the parade ground or the other, and he could see a uniform maladjustment all the way across that parade ground, and you could hear him hollering in your ear.
But he was beloved of the Corps of Cadets, was he not?
Oh, Lord, I can remember after mass, you'd go over to his house, and he would be in one bed, his wife would be in the other, and I remember his wife had some type of brace on her mouth, but nonetheless, you would come over there and try to get a special pass for weekend leave. And he said, okay, Bubba. And he always called us his lambs. And he was a good fella. He really was. And the last correspondence I got from him, I think he's passed over now. I know he has, but he said, he sent me a card and said, Bubba, missed you at Corps Day. But he was a good individual and a World War II veteran and just a wonderful man who made that place, livable for the, pretty hard life that was, enshrined there. So if you can read, anybody can read the Boo about Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Nugent Kivorsky, I think you'd be,
well, in many ways it also serves as a sort of a portrait of a bygone era, does it not?
It does, too.
Well, absolutely. So too with the Lords of Discipline.
Now, I tell you, when that book came out, it brought back some memories to me, let me tell you. Because they had some things that went on down there that were pretty rough. I mean, for anybody who doesn't know anything about the Citadel, it's called the West Point of the South, and of course your other service academies, they have beast barracks the first 3 months of the summer, and you're left alone. At the Citadel, beast barracks, or non-recognition of lower classmen, went from August to the next year in June when you had the official recognition. And you had the fourth class police system in effect. And I tell you, Bob, it was kind of rough. It really was.
I think that's probably the understatement of the evening thus far, Jim.
I mean,
kind of rough.
It was really bad. I mean, they had sweat parties in which they packed you into a shower in full uniform with a rifle and a shako. You know what that shako is? That tall hat like you'd see in Napoleon's army.
Right.
And turn on the showers and stuff like that. People would pass out and fall out on the galleries and stuff. And, of course, there wasn't any supervision except for one tactical officer for four battalions. And you had cadets running that fourth-class system, and they just went wild.
To what? I mean, but that was just straight-up hazing, wasn't it, Jim? I mean, did it serve any military purpose?
I think what it served was it was based upon a knowledge to try to escape from as much of that as you possibly could, and because when you stepped into the barracks, you had to go in that barracks through the sally port with your chin racked in, doing 180 steps a minute, and only on a certain portion of the barracks itself, just a little line to you, and then do a right turn to your room, and but what was the worst thing to me was about in the mess hall, because you had to sit there at, well, the first 3 inches, your chair pop off of your food, and, you know, they had like what they call plebe knowledge, for example, and I don't mean to bore anybody with this, and if I am, just stop me. But, there's, for example, when somebody would say, how is the cow? And I still remember that. She walked, she talked, she's full of chalk. The lacteal fluid of the lobian species is highly prolific to the nth degree. The nth degree referring to how much milk was left in the pitcher. And there's some of that plebe knowledge today that I still remember.
And I don't mean to be dismissive, Jim, but it sounds like fraternity hazing.
Oh, it was a lot worse than that. It was a lot worse than that, I can tell you.
But I mean, having to memorize useless information and
well, you know, basically they do that at all the service academies. They do that. They have certain, you know, your plebe handbook. You know, you had to be able to pop that off, and if you didn't, it was either get down to 25, then more 25, and at 25 became 50, 50 became 75, until you had to be dragged off the quadrangle, basically. It was a rough, rough year for me. It really was. And I can remember one time when I got a phone call from my mother, and, they let me take a phone call. And she said, what is all that screaming and noise I hear? I said, they're having a sweat party. It's the whole battalion. And, of course, my mother just went to pieces over the phone. And I think she probably was fixed to walk out on my father for having sent me there. Of course, he wasn't like that when he was there, you know. It had changed. and it changed because they tried to limit personal services rendered by freshmen to upperclassmen. They tried to stop that General Tucker did. But unfortunately, it had the exact opposite reaction, and it made things rougher. And General Tucker was a good man. He really was. I can remember one thing. I'll stop here. Hello, is everybody there?
Yeah, you're there. You're there.
He had a stroke, and he was trying to make an announcement about he was upset about some things, and these Johnny-come-latelys, and the microphone had a button on it, and this was my junior year, and I was in charge of playing music for the for the whole core, and it was in a huge Calvert Hall. It was called a mess hall, but on the record was Diana Ross singing, "Baby, Baby." Remember that Holland, Dozier Holland?
Sure.
And put Tucker by that mistake when he was making his speech, hit the button and disengaged his speech. And just, it was almost like, you know, it was a segue. He went into the Supreme. And of course, everybody just went nuts. I mean, you know, it was just, it was kind of funny. But nonetheless, just a recollection from my youth. I'll say no more.
No, I don't, I think you say a lot. Chat room's gone kind of quiet. Or not chat room, but the Skype group. Y'all are still here, right?
Yeah, I'm here. Everybody else is here. We're right in the mute buttons.
Oh, okay.
Didn't want to interrupt Jim.
I'll be glad to put on Diana Ross if you want me to. We can all go back in time. Probably predate some of you guys.
Yeah,
not me.
Not me.
Oh, I love that group. I thought they were wonderful.
All right.
Speaking of...
yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
Just something Bill was talking about yesterday about the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Having that military base in the desert. I just sent an email off to you, Bill. Hopefully you'll get it. But there's a book that just came out through the government about that. So, let me know if you get it. I've been having trouble sending emails to you. But, you know, we were just talking about that, and I get this email today about it, about the book.
Where was that you were talking about? What part of the world, the desert? I mean, the desert is...
I think they're talking about here in the States, the Southwest Desert.
Okay,
I'm not sure.
They got one in Nevada that's really famous.
Well, what I remember about the U.S. history was when they were using camels out in the desert. And not the ones you smoke either, the ones you know.
Yeah, the hump day guy.
And I think Jefferson Davis was in on that deal.
Yeah, High Jolly was famous for those camels.
Ah, okay.
He was the camel herder taught the American cavalry to ride camels down in Arizona.
Yep. I know they tried it down there for a while.
You ever ridden a camel, anybody?
But as the old punchline...
Not I.
No.
Oh. The punchline of the joke is the guy telling the new recruit, well, no, most guys ride the camel over to town to the cat house. You know, that was the punchline for that. So. Yeah. All right, that was an old French Foreign Legion joke where the recruit says, what do they do for sex? And one guy says, well, get a horse. And then the guy, it cuts him off and says, I don't want to hear anymore. And the guy catches the guy using a horse, and the guy, you should let me finish, you know. They take the horse to town.
He'll be here all week.
Try the veal.
Yeah, don't forget to tip your waiter.
If you can find any.
Say.
The other thought I had when I was listening to Jim, it's been 30-plus years since I got out of the Navy. 30-plus years since I've even seen the ship I was on. And I can tell you, I could walk through that ship today with no sight and find my way perfectly. And it's like Jim talking about his year at the Citadel there, there's just certain things that somehow stick in your mind, and I think it has to do with military service in a lot of ways, because it's such a fraternity, for lack of a better word. You're there with a group of people, dependent on them, they're dependent on you. But, you know, I've done the exercise. I cannot remember some of the places I've lived in as a kid as well as I remember this ship. And I could find my way literally with no eyes through the ship. I'd love to try it. Unfortunately, it's at the bottom of the ocean now for a barrier reef. But it's just amazing how that happens, how you can go back in time and realize that, gee, I could do this, and I know I could. And,
you know, that's,
you know,
just part
like
of
it. It reigned in your memory. And I wasn't on that ship but for 2 years. You know, 2.5 years of my time in the service, I was on that ship.
What kind of vessel was it, Kevin?
That's not helicopter carriers, the USS Guadalcanal, what they call the LPH, which is landing platform helicopter, is the technical term for it.
Yeah, I think
most of the CH-46s, 53s, the big ones.
Yeah, I need to ask a question.
Go ahead, Larry.
I'm coming in. It's Larry. Hi. One of my, mostly all except for perhaps Sergi, have had experience in the military. That's an experience that I will never have because of my particular circumstances. But what am I missing about that certain cultural...
I was never in, Larry, and I didn't miss anything.
No,
okay. Nor
me.
I. Sure you did.
Peacetime and... They tried to change my classification about 65 or so, and I said, I don't think so. Because now, now they needed bullet stoppers.
Yeah.
60, well, they didn't. 60, 61, you know. They were rejecting 50%, pardon me, of the draftees in the state of Ohio in those days. Because they didn't need warm bodies much.
Yeah, I guess what I was asking is, what is it about the military culture that is, so, how does it shake?
It's an event you won't forget, Larry.
Oh, okay.
Very true.
I was going to say most of all the SR-71s that I worked on are in museums, and all the B-52s and probably the KC-135s I worked on are in a graveyard, or in, I know there's a few D-model B-52s in museums.
That's what shocks me. I don't think I'd want to get into it. That's an old plane.
Yeah, I mean, most of the B-52s I worked on were about twice as old as I was when I worked on them.
Yeah. Well, Jim, you're...
That was 40 years ago.
Jim, what vintage are these 52s there they're flying? Still.
1961 or 60 to 63, I think.
G models.
H models are the only ones operating now.
H? Oh, yeah, that's right, the H models.
That's right.
So, at the very least, they're 50.
Yep.
I mean, that speaks pretty well of a piece of design, but still.
Yeah, the ones I worked on were the D models.
The maintenance crews, a buddy of mine was running an auto shop, and he was had been in the Air Force, and they called him up, and they paid him big money to go back to Germany and work on jets.
See, that's what, Duncan, that's what you and Boss Man Wayne have in common. You both got that common history of working on B-52s.
Yeah, Wayne was at Westover. I've talked to him about that.
Really?
Yeah. Bob?
What did he do? What was this AFSC?
I don't recall specifically, but among other things, well, even after, if I recall correctly, even after he got out of the Air Force, he turned around and worked for Boeing on them as well. So I don't know exactly what he did, but
You'll let me know when you find out.
Oh, I absolutely will.
I was an aircraft electrical repairman, of course.
Oh, that makes sense.
Bob.
Yeah.
Could you excuse me for a minute? I need to see Mrs. Bendover.
Do please.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right, stand by. Standing by. He's told me the stories of, you know, hot, sweaty, and miserable Guam and, you know,
things. Oh, like Guam. That. Guam. I was there for, had to go TDY there for 3 months. It was just, I was on swing shift, and it rained the same time every night, right at dusk. As soon as it get dark, it start raining.
Yeah, just convection stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
No,
go ahead, Larry, please.
I know that we colonized, if for lack of a better term, the Philippines and, you know, Hawaii, and before it became a state and all that. But what about American Samoa and Guam and Tonga and those places? Were those kind of overrun by or dominated by American interests as well? Because they're not talked about in the history of our imperialistic.
There's a breakout, Larry, between what happened prior to the Second World War and what happened after. The brutality that we inflicted on the Philippines is almost unspeakable.
And it's almost forgotten.
In fact, and I'm pretty sure you're familiar with it. You know Mark Twain's The War Prayer, right, Larry? Larry.
Well, I know Mark Twain.
There was a piece that was published after his death, because he was so beloved that his friends and publishers said, Sam, you can't publish this. The American people will turn on you on a dime. And one of those pieces is called The War Prayer. And it is a brutal examination of martial fervor and the you know, what it really means to quote unquote support the troops. And he came to it after reading some of the reports of the monstrous brutality that the United States engaged in against the Philippines at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century.
During the Philippine insurrection.
Yep.
That's what it's called.
What a name, yeah. It was their insurrection, yeah.
My grandfather was in the Philippines right after that.
Yeah, I'll never forget seeing those photos you shared.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the ones with all the skulls. Good Lord, those were people at one time.
Yeah, those were the Maoris or something like that.
Oh, the Maoris? Well, the Philippines are an example of a people that they've had a very sad history, much like the indigenous people all over the world. Yeah. They were never given a chance to develop. I guess Spain dominated them. I don't know their entire history, but I know that Spain dominated them, and then we went in there under the pretense that we were going to save them from Spain, and went in and dominated them ourselves, the American government.
But the history of exploitation goes back ever so much further than that, Larry. The Philippines had the unfortunate geographical luck of being the perfect staging ground for Spanish interaction during the era of, you know, the conquistadors, Spanish interaction with China. And, there's one lesson perhaps there's no such thing as a benign colonial power. Even when the colonial power it thinks it's being benign, it's still essentially oppressive. And God knows the Spanish were brutal to the Philippines.
They were brutal everywhere they put their foot, and the English weren't much better.
Well,
that's true.
Yeah, it's colonial. I mean, the takeaway is colonialism is evil. Just is.
I've read stories where there was a British guy or an Englishman that got lost on an island, And he saw a ship coming, but he hid. And then he heard Spanish voices, and he knew enough not to come out because they would have killed him on the spot, even though he was out in the middle of the nowhere in the South Seas.
Well, you know, most of the cities in Virginia, I don't know about West Virginia, I haven't studied, but Virginia have Native American names. And a lot of the rivers, too. So, you know, it's like that. The state of Virginia originally had a Native American name. And then England came over and decided that they were going to name Virginia for the Virgin Queen.
Sorry.
You know, what can you say? I don't know. And then North Carolina, I don't know much about North Carolina.
Caroline.
So,
may I
interject something here?
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Have you ever heard of the outdoor drama called The Lost Colony at the Maniac?
Oh, yeah.
Well, my sister used to, in her college years, was like a stage manager there. And they had this woman who played Queen Elizabeth, who was I think she did Summerstock and Broadway and stuff like that, but she was sort of in her declining years and had taken to drink somewhat. So she came on stage, and when the line came for her to say, and I honor this land in honor of me, or I name it in honor of me, England's Virgin Queen, she added to it, and if any of you out there believe I'm a virgin, you're a goddamn fool.
And it performer. Yep.
And it broke up the whole thing. But nonetheless, the next year, that place was destroyed by a hurricane. And this lady had a beach house down there. She was a permanent resident, I guess, in the summer. But of all the pieces they recovered from that Lost Door Theater, from their props, was the Queen's Throne. And it was washed up under her beach house.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, it's billed as America's Outdoor Drama, The Lost Colony.
Oh, yeah. My sister goes up there every year because, you know, she spent a lot of good times there with friends. And, you know, it was a place where my parents would trundle me off for a couple of weeks before I went to summer camp. And so when my parents, he went to pick me up, we were going to a cast party. I was like 13. It was naked except for a breech clout. And you can imagine the reaction my parents had to that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, they say, what are you doing to your little brother? Well, how dare you?
Jim, what was this theater called?
It's called The Lost Colony.
It's in Mandio, North Carolina, the Outer Banks. It's the story of the Lost Colony, the Sir Walter Raleigh's attempt to colonize the at North Carolina, you know, what, 15, what?
Oh, like 47, something like that, thereabout, 1538. I can't remember the exact date. But I tell you, the island people up there were some interesting people.
So is this the Lost Colony of Roanoke?
Yes.
Or mm-hmm. Where Dare County is, or
yeah, and named for
Dare County,
named for Virginia Dare, yes,
for the first English,
yeah, okay,
supposedly born in America, something like that. Yeah,
I thought there was some kind of a wine when I was a kid that was called Virginia Dare wine. It
might very well have been.
Yeah, people would drag anything out to try to sell something, you know.
Well, I guarantee you, I bet that wine would definitely put some lead in your pencil.
Yeah, Bill, to change the subject. About music, somebody told me that Charlie Musselwhite was a very interesting character.
Yes, he is.
I don't know. I didn't verify it, but he was from Mississippi.
Yep.
And I also wanted to ask you about before Butterfield and Mike Bloomfield went down to the clubs to play with the blues greats of the 40s and 50s. Was there a blues, you know, was that the first time that blues was introduced to the white college crowd?
Really?
Was that the first?
There was a lot of acoustic performers in the early 60s, a lot of folk singers, you know, that would dabble with a 12 bar now and then, but the more modern, the electric stuff, there was a couple, a guy promised me a CD by a couple of country players.
And I know the guy knows this music because he recorded, he was the man running the four-track board on my first recording. And I know he knows this. And these were country guys, but he says, Bill, these guys will knock you out because they could, the countrymen. Well, who was the singing brakeman? Jimmy
Rogers?
Rogers, yeah. That's a funny thing, too. Beside him, there was a guitar player that recorded and played with Muddy Waters named Jimmy Rogers. And then there was a pop singer in the 50s with the same name. It's confusing as hell, you know. But, yeah, Jimmy was, he could sing. And these guys talked about how they, these white performers talked about how they heard what they heard and how they mixed it into what they were doing. And that mixture of stuff is what often gives something a lot of strength, the more you pick up from somebody else. Because you intertwine people. I mean, the old New Orleans jazz, a lot of the songs they played were almost pop stuff, you know, in the day. But when they played it, came out in that style of the three-man front line and the intertwining of the instruments. And because that's what makes it, is just you mix different cultures together, you can come up with some awful good stuff. And people are funny. There's a great book on the 442nd Japanese outfit, the Regimental Combat Team that was drafted out of the guys in the camps in the States and in Honolulu. And when these guys hooked up for basic training, the Americans, the Japanese fellas born in America, kept referring to the guys from Hawaii as Buddha heads. they had to duke it out when they first met in typical young male fashion in those days. You had to duke it out a few times, and the next thing you know, you're friends.
An addendum coming in from Irish Dave, Bill, talking about Jimmy Rogers. Yodeling brakeman is the more precise term. Good morning, Captain.
Exactly. He's right, yes. Because the man, I remember, I was a little kid, and I heard people yodeling. I said, how the hell do they do that? Something hits you. You know, sometimes you're... Well, my dad was a pretty good gypsy violinist, they tell me, and... So, you know, sometimes you're passed along genes, and his dad, his brother was a great electronic tech, and I picked up a little of that, too. You know, hell, I could change a light bulb for crazy.
Well, there's a lot of, going back to what you were talking about, the transition into what Larry referred to as the college crowd, what we're talking about is the mainstreaming and the gentrification, if you will, of more regionalized and certainly ethnic forms, and by ethnic, I'm not doing that thing that the for-profit media do where ethnic means black.
Yeah.
Certainly there's that with regard to jazz, but you can also say the same thing about the rise of the folk music scene that brought in Peter, Paul, and Mary, and even Bob Dylan.
Of course.
The acoustic, well, it was all acoustic, I guess you could say, but hillbilly music, country music, the folk styles of the Scots-Irish ballad that gets translated into Appalachia.
Yep.
And so, you know, as soon as somebody figures out a way to make a dollar off of it, and by that I'm not talking about the musicians, I'm talking about the promoters and the record labels and, you know, what have you, then, you know, well, look, we've got a hot new thing.
Bob, you hit something. I always wanted to find a fella who could sketch well or who could draw well or who could, you know, do things with, you know, computer photography. And I have guys dressed in different musical outfits, you know, the cowboy hat and the beret on the jazz player and this. And then I have a short, fat guy with sporty clothes on. And he didn't have any instrument, but the question was, Of these people, who made the most money in the music business?
Yeah, the guy with the sporty clothes and no instrument.
That was the sick humor that I always had, you know. Cynicism, if it's...
The guy who couldn't play a guitar, a bass, drums, piano, or a horn, but could damn well play an adding machine.
You got it. Because cynicism is sometimes a way of laughing at something that's really nasty, but...
you get a cheap laugh out of it instead of the feeling really rotten about the whole thing. Because somehow or other, being loose with stuff sometimes keeps you a lot saner, I think. Because that way, Bob, you can continue to fight like you are, you know, with the ache act and such. If you can somehow come up with something that day will make you laugh, then you get the strength to go back and battle with what you have to do.
Yeah.
Hey, Kevin, if you don't mind, I had a question coming in from Isaac, and again, it's kind of personal, so if you do, it's okay. But he wanted to know how you lost your sight.
Combination of things. My left eye got hit right on the eye in the Navy, and it developed a traumatic cataract. And when I, several years later, when I tried to get the cataract taken off, the retina detached. On the right eye, that's mostly related to all sorts of things like glaucoma. There was a slight retinal detachment. I've got a glaucoma implant in it, and I've learned that any type of surgery to my eyes is not good for it. It just reacts bad to any kind of trauma. And so over the years, after the second glaucoma surgery, I was about at 2200. It gradually just has gone down now to where I can see lights and shadows. But I would say if you opened a book and looked up the top five eye diseases, I'd probably have most of them. So, you know, it's kind
of... That's a hell of a hand to get dealt.
All of them.
Sure as hell is.
Yeah.
Anything that's gene-induced is a... I was running a metal-cutting machine, cutting out stuff for a friend of mine who developed a use of Kevlar for clutches and brakes. Industrial stuff, and it was laser power. And sometimes I wonder, because we didn't wear any eye protection or anything. None of the guys did, but me being the oldest, maybe that's what, you know. Or it's because it's something I never heard of until he told me I had it.
And in both of your case, well, Jim, you said something a minute ago.
Yeah, I said glaucoma. Basically, that's ocular pressure within the aqueous humor that can distend the lens. Is that basically how it works? Is excessive interocular pressure?
Yeah. In fact, the first surgery I had on the eye, they put a glaucoma implant for the glaucoma. They put a glaucoma implant in, and that blocked up. Well, I kept telling the doctor my eye hurt, and he said, "Well, it's just the implant pressing up against the bone there on the top of your eye," and I kept telling him, "No, that's not it." Well, finally, on Monday morning, this happened over the weekend, of course, on Monday morning I got up and went to him, he was going to see me one way or the other. He checked my pressure in the eye, and it was 80. Normal is like 9 to 15, somewhere in there.
Oh, my Lord. So he said that it was because your eyeball was pressing against the ocular orbit?
Yeah, you described it pretty good, but I guess a non-scientific explanation for it would be like pressure building up in anything. It just crushes itself from within.
Yeah, your eyeball's kind of like an egg in a way. It's got all that aqueous humor inside it, correct?
Yep. Yeah, in fact, that was one of the other things I had was the vitreous slit in my eye. One day it cracked. It looked like I was looking out of cracked glass, like out of a windshield that had been hit with a hammer. Couldn't see anything.
Oh, my God.
And they took me in and replaced the vitreous fluid. And so I was able to get some sight back from that, but that's pretty much where they discovered the glaucoma. So...
And Isaac, with a follow-up question for both you, Bill, and you, Kevin, how long did it take you to adapt? And I guess that's assuming that you consider yourself having fully adapted.
I'm still working on it.
Yeah, and I would say the same thing. You don't, you know, I think I'm still adapting to it.
My close friends gave me the nasty, some stuff that had me laughing because they know me. And they said, Bill, we told you about when you were a teenager with those adult magazines. That, you know, and because I have a sixth sense of humor, I could laugh at it because we all heard that when we were kids. I don't know if we all did, but I sure as hell did. Spending 4 years in a Catholic children's home run by nuns. In fact, they just had a situation at this place in Cleveland or in Parma where they now have, no pun intended, lay people doing it. And one of the males that worked there was fixing up a 13-year-old girl with paid dates. Nice guy, huh?
Oh, jeez.
Aces.
Put your foot up his ass.
Wow.
Sorry about my language.
He was fixing her up with... Fixing her up with what?
No.
I didn't hear what he... I heard him say, yeah. Fixing her up.
Well, yeah, she was 13 years old, and he's a cottage parent in this joint. Supposedly a guy with social work degree, but I doubt if they're even hiring guys with a degree, and they'll hire anybody. They can, you know what they're doing all over the map when it comes to jobs today. If you can fog a mirror,
oh, yeah,
you got the job if you work cheap enough. And this guy had arranged for a couple of dates for a 13-year-old kid. I thought, holy God. You know, come on.
Arranging for dates, is that another word for pimping?
You're damn right. And the guy probably wasn't even dressed right. He wasn't even a well-dressed guy, just some schmuck, you know. Because I still have a lot of old thinking in me because... You know, I don't care what somebody else does. I mean, I had plenty of... I had a situation where I ended up... I was 36, and these two girls were pushing their sister at me. I find out later she was 16. I knew her. I ran into her again for a while when she was in her late 40s, and I wouldn't even bother with her, you know. But, hell, I didn't... you know, when some woman says that tells me their sister is 18... And this one used to try to pretend to be, she'd stand in front of a stage and give you the old Stevie Nicks movement routine, you know. And if I had enough gin in me, it was, you know, like anybody else. It was just one of those things, so, but when I see a guy who's hired as a cottage parent of some kind getting caught doing that, it really burns my ass. Because, you talk about a phony, you know. Sorry, fellas. I mean,
I would venture to say that that was probably a more common thing than we would like to admit.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of the blind programs out here, that's what they did is they sent their kids off. Like in Colorado, this is the only blind school in for like three or four states. So people would send their kids here to the blind school in Colorado and they'd stay up here for the entire school year. And that's what they had is college parents. And, you know, every so often a teacher would get fired and you really wouldn't know why, or a teacher would disappear. Just got swept under the rug is what happened. And you hear about that.
That happens everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't know. I'm a believer in... Believe me, I saw that sexual revolution play out in front of me from, you know, when I was 20 when Kennedy was shot. So by 67, you know, you're 24, 25, and that merry-go-round had started to turn pretty fast.
Oh, boy, did it ever.
Yeah, especially when you made a living working in bars and everybody was, the audience was as shit-faced as the band was, you know. And not to mention the smoke, but I'm a second generation of that stuff. My old man got busted in 45 or 6 with a pound, but his brother worked for MAFIA, and that was easy bribe, you know. Cost the old man a lot of money, but he was, you know, it was that pre-bail payment, you know.
I don't think I know what you talked about, because like I told Bob about my bong with the aquarium motor on it.
Don't leave the stirrups out, Jim.
Yeah, you had to have stirrups to use that thing. That's for damn sure, because I'll guarantee you one thing. If you didn't have your feet planted in those stirrups, you'd go straight through the wall into the next room. That was some good stuff. But, you know, looking back on those days, I don't regret a minute of it. It was good times, high times. It was a lot of good fun, and you know, not the.
And you never turned, and despite both of you, well, any one of us probably,
and not the
nobody turned into an axe murderer, right?
No, hell no. All you wanted was sit down, mellow out, and you know, listen to some good music, and you know.
And the only thing it turned into being a gateway drug for was Doritos.
That's about it. You got it, Doritos or.
Oh, dude, Twinkies.
Well, you know, at that time, I had a recipe for pate, and that stuff, God only knows, and I would make it with chicken livers and butter and onion and applejack. And I'll tell you one thing.
Oh, Lord, that sounds delicious. Get the crackers.
Well, it was. I mean, that's what I'm telling you. My God in heaven, you could just do everything you possibly could with that pate, with that recipe, and, you know, whatever comestibles and good drinks you had to have, whether it was a tall Budweiser or whether it was a good drink of scotch or you know, those were good times, high times. I sent you an email the other night about that place I lived called Duncan and Marijuana Street.
Yeah.
My God, that was a neighborhood back in Columbia then, and Jesus Christ, and across the street were a group called the Night Into Day People, and they reversed the clock, and they would sleep all day, and they had this huge porch in the back of their house in which they would, 6 o'clock p.m., that was start date, 6 a.m. was end date, I guess, if you could get down the stairs or just find some place to crash. But I still look back on those times with some fond memories and good times and no violence and none of this other crap about heroin or whatever, or crack or... I remember we used to see if we could take a glass pipe and, you know, make some hash out of it and stuff like that. Hell, that was, you know, if you could do that. But, you know, as far as the good stuff, the lid was 20 bucks an ounce. And, well, I go on here. But I had my share of good times, and I'm glad I had them. Had some good friends to have them with. And that's all I can say.
Well, should I tell my story?
Go ahead.
I'd love to hear it, buddy. You do. Knock yourself out.
You remember that paper that was in the Cheech and Chong Big Bad Blue album?
Yeah.
We rolled one of those up over in Thailand, and we had 17 guys inside a bungalow, and I mean, passing that thing around. A bungalow is just a like a one room bedroom,
just a hooch.
All hooch, you know, up on stilts.
Yeah.
And in there, and just walk in the door, you could get a contact high, and every time you drew on it, it'd light back up again because it burned so hot on the end. I forget how big around that thing was.
Well, I watched a guy go down to Meigs County in Ohio, and they started a lot of husbandry on the stuff. And a lot of stuff that came back from Nam with friends of mine and brought it back was dynamite stuff.
Well, you know, one of the best shotguns you could ever get was out of a rifle.
Yeah.
To blow right into the end of it and come right out, and bam, you were just, you were back in America.
Well,
I can remember listening to Lou Reed, "Sally Can't Dance No More." Remember that song?
Yeah.
Because she's done falling on the floor or some kind of crap like that. But I remember a lot of those good songs. White Witch, Lou Reed, God only knows. There were so many good bands then. And like I say, gentlemen, just good times. Good times when you were young and you thought you were invincible and nothing could hurt you or kill you. You weren't worried about a lot of things you're worried about today, but it all played a part, and I'm glad to live through it.
Well, my story was Uncle Horn made a few bucks for during the French War selling poppy stuff, you know.
Yeah, like opium?
Yeah. And smack probably too, but hell, who am I to say that what he was doing was... Well, I've also noticed that heroin's been on the rise.
Well, it's a pretty good business model considering Uncle Sam did some pretty serious trade in Bolivian marching powder in the 1980s during the whole Iran-Contra fiasco.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're not...
At the same time that Nancy was saying, well, just say no.
Oh, Lord have mercy. You know, the only time I've ever smoked opium was one time I was visiting some friends in Charlotte, and I said, you know, I've got a toothache, and this thing hurts like a bitch. And these two girls in the front of the convertible we were riding said, honey, smoke some of this. I'm going to tell you something, that toothache hurts now.
Yeah, that stuff is very effective. And Hammett was writing stuff that was set before, you know, 1915, the Continental Ops stuff, and heroin was all over the place. One guy was drinking laudanum. You remember that, Bob Red Harvest.
Well, but good God, you mentioned laudanum. That was, and I mentioned this before, and it's worth bringing up again. The David Bartons of the world, and you know how much esteem I hold for him, with this notion that you've got a bunch of pious church-going founders of the country, you couldn't drink the water in the United States. You know, you had to bug out of Philadelphia or you'd be dead of yellow fever in the course of a summer.
Or cholera.
Yeah, exactly. And neither of which was a problem before the white folks got here, by the way. I'm just saying. But the framers of the The Constitution and the particularly the Continental Congress that considered the Declaration of Independence were in no uncertain terms drunker than Adam's off ox. I mean, we're talking about an average consumption rate for wine of something on the order of 3 gallons a day, with some guys adding in a pint of laudanum back. Now I think about something like I couldn't stay upright in a chair.
But, you know, Samuel Taylor Coleridge and Edgar Allan Poe, I can tell you one thing. I think they have some interesting trips for that stuff and wrote some interesting stuff, even though Coleridge couldn't forget the rest of his poem, Xanadu, right?
In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree where Alpha Sacred River ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunlit sea.
Yeah, there you go. You got it.
Did I hear you correct, Bob, in that you just said gallons?
Yes.
Good night. They drank like homies.
I couldn't be.
And now a moment. And now Sergi with a moment with homies.
I couldn't pee that much. I mean, you know, God Almighty. They must have had bladders like tank cars.
Well, when me and another guy were the only two Caucasians on stage, you know, the older bass player brought in a mason jar full of white stuff, and I had to taste it, and my God.
Oh, that...
So you guys who are home brewer, home distillers down in the mountains and down south, they could make stuff that... I never had curly hair except that night, you know?
You know, you gotta be careful with that stuff, Bill, because it'll make you go blonde. Never mind.
No, I didn't drink it. I was 20... Probably 23, 24 when that was happening, so that was a...
But the fact of the matter...
Seven, you know?
Yeah, the fact of the matter is...
Well, you got to get some good stuff now.
Yeah, I mean, the good stuff is kind of... Yeah, you don't want it to have been run through the radiator of a 66 Buick.
No, hell.
And that's why it's considered good form if you're offering yours to somebody who's never had yours. You put a little out on a plate and burn it. And if it burns a nice color, a nice colorless flame or a nice blue,
or gunpowder?
No,
Well, they used to gunpowder too with it.
Hooch.
Oh yeah.
Moonshine. Yeah, but if it burns reds and greens and oh look, that's pretty. Don't drink it because that's Prestone flavored moonshine.
Oh, or the bubbles in it when you shake it up and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've had one experience with White Lightning in my life, and that's when I had invited by a fellow teacher of mine, and who was a retired Air Force colonel. He was a good friend of mine. He was Elliot Brogdon, a wonderful guy. And he said, Jim, you going home to see your mom and dad? I said, yeah, I'm supposed to go over there and pick up some stuff for my mom. And he said, well, listen, let me give you a shot of this. And I had one shot of that, and then another shot of that. And I said, Colonel, I'll be damned if I can get out the front door, much less drive. He said, I'm going to call your mother. So he called my mother, and he said, Ms. Anderson, he said, Jim came over to see Luanda and me, that was his wife, and I've given you some moonshine. And she just said, just tell him not for, belay the trip home and just put him to bed. Because that stuff really would walk right up your back and kick you right in the head.
Well, there's a reason they call it Pop Skull, Jim.
Yeah. Well, I found out that night, and I'll tell you, it was just like, you know, you wouldn't want to light a cigarette around something like that.
Oh, no. And when it's well made, it's not nasty. And you do two or three little blasts of that, and the next thing you know, you're just wandering around behind the little animals, like Jim Stafford said.
Well, hell yeah. Yeah, because it really doesn't taste that bad, but the effect is just, I mean, you're drinking, what, 190 proof or something like that? Or...
Yeah.
You guys are making me laugh if I know someone that's that makes it in the family.
We had a contingent of good old boy electricians on that Bechtel powerhouse I worked on in 2001. Had to bring out some of their shine and do the little light it on fire stuff demonstration for me, and they kept going, try it, you'll like it. And I said, I haven't drank hard stuff in years. I got tired of waking up praying to the porcelain god.
Yes. Remember the first time you ever really got into it, and all of a sudden you tried to go to bed, and all of a sudden the room felt like you were on the tilt-a-whirl?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying, Oh God, if I ever get over this, I'll never do it again. And there's 7 days, and there's 7 days later, you're again.
I was just going back to the role of mind altering substances in early America. I just went and looked up the outfitting of Lewis and Clark's expedition. And it's funny the extent, because I've read about this before, it's funny to the extent to which this is suppressed, but they took, they took barrels of whiskey with them. Not a barrel, barrels. And, it's not like there were 50 people going. I mean, they were gone for a couple of years, but they took barrels of whiskey, and then I finally found one list that confesses that they took 30 gallons of strong wine in 6 iron-bound kegs. So they took 6 five-gallon barrels of so-called strong wine. Now, what is that, 12, 13, 14, 15% alcohol, probably? Yeah. But
so you think every Indian tribe they met up with, they had to give them a little fire water?
Turned them on to it. Sure did.
Oh, and there's these long inventory lists of gifts that they took. Yeah.
It's a strange thing. I used to hear this expression. Dope will get you through times of no morality a lot better than morality will get you through times of no dope.
Amen.
Yeah, but that was based on a Freewheeling Franklin saying.
Yeah, wasn't it? Yeah.
And dope will get you through times of no money better than money will get you through times of no dope.
Yeah, I think I saw that paraphrase in a magazine I used to take called High Times.
The Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. And the...
That Freddy's cat.
And the stuff out of the crumb, by Crumb, like Mr. Natural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
And that big baby he always had over your shoulder.
Well, the guy that drew Natural, he was working for
American Greetings at one time, so I would see him around some of the parties in Cleveland here in the 60s. And then, what the hell was his name? Mr. Natural and, you know, the
R. Crumb?
Yes, R. Crumb. Yeah, the underground comics were real big, yeah.
Remember Kathy Toughbuns?
No.
Oh, God. I feel like I missed so much.
I mean, you know, she was one with all the exaggerated buttocks and the real tight jeans, cut off things and stuff like that. Kind of like a, some sort of a version of Little Abner, I don't know. But they call her Kathy Toughbun.
Well, the thing that I remember doing earliest was a Vicks inhaler. Take that inhaler, pull out that cotton, throw it in a cup of coffee, drink it. And you know what it was.
Benzedrine. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just relearned this year in print. I heard it from a real author, not one of my buddies in the alley, that the guys flying out of England to Germany were outfitted with bennies or something to help them stay awake for that long trip.
Well,
that was,
you know,
one hell of a flight.
Well, you know, Providen was the first of the speed type things. It came out in 1936. And I know Hitler was hooked on it.
Yep.
And I know also that David O. Selznick was hooked on it. So that's what kept him going through all, you know, he was like making three movies at once in 1939, like Gone with the Wind and, oh Lord, Rebecca, and he had three films going at one time, and he just literally stayed up all the time and was just totally obsessive compulsive about everything. Bob and I were talking about all the memos and stuff he'd write, but I mean, you know, he was definitely on speed.
Well, in the 50s, if your mother wanted to lose some weight, 50s, early 60s, she'd go to the doctor. I remember my mother bringing home the things they used to call Christmas treats. But I would take one. When I had to get up and go to work early, I'd pop one of those, go to work, and I'd come home and take a shower and go to sleep. I had seen the reaction on too many people and said, I don't want to do that. I mean, you got high when you needed to. You know, you sped a little bit if you needed to, but, man, I've seen too many guys that were losing hair and teeth when they were in their 20s from that shit, so I stayed away from it. Reefer was the thing.
Well, the thing that does teeth in around here these days is meth.
Oh, yeah.
And it is... I mean, anymore, Rafe, skinny, and no teethus, and wow, somebody's tweaking. It's a dead giveaway.
Yeah,
that's the term, tweakers.
Yeah.
Well, I feel the same way about crack, because I saw coke come in, you know, in the 70s and playing bars, and all of a sudden, and one girl bought $300 worth, and I smoked it with her, and this was a woman who used to like to make love, but until that night came along, I said, the hell with this stuff. I went home and lay in bed till it wore off, and I'd never touch it again. Because I was conscious about it, as I've talked to one of our buddies, that wrote in tonight, it was just, there's something, if I just felt like with Smack. Smack is big in Lake County out here east of me. They just busted about 10 guys in Euclid, Ohio last couple weeks ago. And I always felt that if Smack could take down guys like Charlie Parker and what's her name, the great female singer?
Billie Holiday?
Well, yes. If it could take them down, it would have no kicking the short, fat, white harmonica player singer. Kicking him in the ass would be easy for them. Because with a buddy who borrowed a belt so he could tie his arm off in 67, offered me the needle, and I said no.
Well,
maybe
here.
I just knew too much. And who was the great comic that heroin just killed? Lenny Bruce. See, that was, you know, those guys were around when I was young, old enough to understand what was going on, you know? It's something about growing up in a housing project where you got a quick education to these social problems. I used to drink cheap wine with these guys, a couple of Korean War vets,
and they'd pass the jug around, and I'd get to hit that. Who was it? Ernesto and Julio Gallo. Yes, and that great winemakers. As in, what's the word, Bob? You there, Bob?
Yeah, I'm here.
What's the word?
What?
Thunderbird.
Yeah.
Oh my Lord.
30 twice. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. Remember when wine coolers came out and Bartles and James.
Yeah.
And nobody really associated it with Gallo, but it turns out it was their joke on the rest of the world because that was the name of their dogs.
Well, listen, Bob, don't forget Ripple and Boone's Farm.
Oh yeah, Boone's Farm. Yeah, it was your apple. That was the apple stuff, Boone's.
Oh, they had apple. They had strawberry.
A lot of that.
Henny Green Springs.
Oh, good God. I'd almost forgotten that stuff.
Yeah, I'm with them.
And you know, we don't have the list complete unless somebody says Mad Dog 2020.
Oh, yeah. I had a buddy of mine who was drinking that in the 80s. And this guy had 3 degrees. You know.
Well, it's just cheap wine with pure grain alcohol added.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, back in the 80s, Coke was supposedly the designer drug and all this kinds of stuff. I can remember one time I had done some of that with this guy who came over to see me. And when I got over that, I had to actually go next door to these guys who lived next door to me. I said, do you have anything like Librium or whatever? And they gave me 2 tickets home, 2 pills of Librium. And that's the last time I ever even touched that stuff.
Yeah,
well, let me back us up for a minute, because oddly enough, somehow or another, the conversation has actually caused something to bubble to the surface that's newsworthy.
Literally?
Yeah, literally. Well, okay, there are no real bubbles. But, no, you know, there's not just 2 Koch brothers. There's 3. There's Charles and David, and they're the ones who are doing the greatest amount of harm to the planet.
Yeah.
And then there's a third brother, Bill, who sort of was understood to be the normal one. It turns out he's not. Palm Beach Daily News has a story about Bill Koch addressing the Florida, the Palm Beach Chamber of Commerce. And why he chose this moment, you know, maybe the audience was right, whatever. But he got around to talking about a carbon tax. And, of course, I think a carbon tax is appropriate. I never felt real good about cap and trade because it seemed like just another hustle. But an outright carbon tax, you produce this much, you pay this much money. I mean, look, if it incentivizes people to quit smoking by hanging $2 worth of tax on a pack of cigarettes, then why wouldn't it incentivize a power company to quit pumping CO2 in the air to put a tax on that, right? I mean, sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander.
Yep.
Yeah. So he got around to carbon taxes or a CO2 tax, and supposedly moderate Bill Koch told the Florida the Palm Beach Chamber of Commerce that anybody who advocates for a carbon tax is, in his words, on LSD.
And there's some talk about that. That's
well, I mean, the reason I bring it up is, what does that mean? I mean, we're still demonizing things that are not necessarily awful. You can sit here and make the case that, for instance, prescription drugs, prescription narcotics, sold on the black market on the streets in small town West Virginia are burning this state to the ground.
Well, I'm afraid.
And what it hasn't gotten, meth does. But you know, something like acid. No, I don't. I don't get. I mean, I don't care for it. I'm retired from it. But you know, no. So, but this. What I'm getting at here is this persistent desire among people who live for no other purpose than to destroy the ability of this planet to support life. They demonize the people who want it to be continue to be habitable by human beings by saying that they are in some way altered by illicit substances. And that pisses me off.
Well, at least these people have an excuse. These people who say this is the cause of it They don't, because they're supposedly the ones who are straight and the ones who are trying to, you know, palm their own misgivings and misdeeds off onto other people who really, in certain cases, or all cases, if they're all on LSD, have no control over what's going on, you know?
Well, and you can go read this for yourselves at PalmBeachDailyNews.com, but this... Do you remember when, maybe it was Joe Barton out of Texas, I mean, the guy's dumber than a bag of hammers, said that, and then 1L Michelle Bachmann got up behind him and said, that's right, CO2 is not bad for us because CO2 is natural, and it's in our soda pop, how can it be bad? I mean, you know, this really, really head-splitting stupid.
I wish you'd go and take a nap by one of those places where it's produced underground and it's killed like villages of people.
Well, they got a CO2 atmosphere on Mars. I advocate that Republicans move to Mars if CO2 is so benign.
Well, I think you need to go there.
But along the lines of that kind of stupidity, Bill Koch in this address to the Palm Beach Chamber of Commerce said, humans produce their share of carbon dioxide naturally, and taxes aren't levied on them.
Oh, my Lord. What's she going to do? Try to advertise or...
Well, no, this isn't a she. This is a he.
Well, Michelle Bachmann is the same... I'm sorry.
The government's going to come out with a fart museum. You got
to
wear...
I was fixing to say, well, what are they going to do, tax farts?
Yeah. That would be the next thing, if they can figure out a way to use it.
So, instead, I think it turns out that Bill Koch is the dude who's on acid, because he also said, coal is relatively low in price, and... oil's been pretty cheap until recently. There's an abundance of natural gas, and the price is almost competitive with coal. So drill, baby, drill, burn, baby, burn, die, baby, die.
Well, you know, these people aren't on anything except themselves, and basically their own desire to make a dollar. And they don't give a shit about you or anybody else but themselves. You know,
hey, Jim,
and they think they're going to be immune from it.
You've got a lot of Russian expertise. Was old man Koch over... working with Stalin about the oil business?
Yes. I mean, I'm not jumping in on Jim, but the answer is yes.
Yeah, Stalin was definitely an equal opportunity employer.
Well, I just wondered if he stiffed the guy or something. That's what made him...
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. Old man Koch went over because, you know, he was such a patriotic American. Well, the business of America is business, so old man Koch... went over to do some oil business with Uncle Joe.
What year was it? What time, Jim?
Oh, Jesus. Late 40s, I think.
Yeah, after the war.
At that time, that was pushing it because we had taken a different stance on Stalin, you know. NATO and a few other things were not for him just to, you know.
So he goes over there, he builds infrastructure for Joe, and then comes back and... I guess didn't get as much money out of Stalin as he wanted, and suddenly becomes a rabid anti-communist. And that's about the time that he opens up his checkbook and writes a check to a guy named Robert Welch, who founds a little book club, a little coffee klatch called the John Birch Society, which then in turn immediately declared to the world that, and you can't make this stuff up, that Dwight David Eisenhower was a communist simp.
Oh, yeah, that's when McCarthy got his ass in the sling, wasn't it, when he went after Ike and George Marshall?
He got his ass really in a sling when he went after the Army.
Yeah.
And when he went after the Army, I mean, people had had enough of Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn and all that stuff. And it's frankly, you know, I'm not trying to be offensive here, but, you know, Bobby Kennedy wanted to be Joe McCarthy's chief counsel. And Robbie and Cohn is the one who blindsided Kennedy and got the job as being his chief counsel. So I guess Roy Cohn did Bobby Kennedy a favor when he took over, and Cohn, of course, you know, went on, you know, to play the part that he played in the McCarthy hearings, and when they went up against Joseph Welch, and that's when he said, "Have you no decency, sir," or whatever, and McCarthy went down after that. Kennedy went his own way, and then, of course, the Joseph Welch played the part of the judge in Otto Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder.
Oh, and by the way, just another news story worth considering. And I know the high esteem that in which you hold John Kennedy, you having mentioned him, Jim.
Well, I was talking about Robert
Kennedy. I know, but
right, of course. Yes, certainly.
You're and everybody here, especially those who are older than I, remember how the right wingers in Texas were behaving about JFK's November 1963 visit to Dallas.
Yep. Oh, boy, they've got a bunch of stuff coming out on TV about that, too. Yeah.
So, guess what? It was yesterday that President Obama went to Texas to talk about the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. Well, never one to let a good bad public relations opportunity fly past him. And your mention of McCarthy made me recall this, Jim. Tail gunner Ted Cruz jumped out there and told the President of the United States that he was damned well not welcome in Texas.
Yeah, I can remember basically the same things that came out in banner headlines on November 22nd, 23rd, or 22nd, or 21st, 23rd about Kennedy coming to Texas to try to, you know, make amends between Democrats down there and the Lone Star State.
Let's see. He was there. It wasn't yesterday. It was Wednesday, actually. Ted Cruz said, President Obama's trip to Texas brings nothing with it but broken promises. He promised that Americans could keep their health care plans. We were told premiums would go down, that jobs would be created, and we now know these are all false promises. President Obama should take his broken promises tour elsewhere so Texans can continue focusing on the solutions that have allowed our state to become and remain the nation's economic and job creation powerhouse. Meanwhile, Texas, of course, has more uninsured Americans than any other state in the Union.
That, and we are not the economic powerhouse of the nation. California is.
Yes, absolutely. It's California. It's the fifth largest economy in the world, or it used to be.
And absolutely.
Covered California works just fine.
Yeah, it's only San Cruz, a jar of Preparation H for aftershave, you know.
Yeah, but then his head would shrink down to the size of a pin, and at that point his brains would still be rattling. It astonishes me that man is hailed as some sort of intellectual, but I guess the standard for intellectuals in the right wing is wildly different from what it is over here among the normal people, because consider. Zombie-eyed Granny Starver, Paul Ryan, is an intellectual. Rand Paul Goatwig Boy Plagiarizer is an intellectual. Ted Cruz is an intellectual. Marco Rubio is an intellectual. Crispy Cream Christie is an intellectual in Republican circles.
Wait a minute, you can't compare those people to, like, Jacob Javits or... I mean, he was a Republican.
They're long gone, Larry. That's old school.
There were a few decent ones when I was a kid.
You know,
Mike looks better now than he did to me then. Maybe it's because of the slide downhill.
By the way, Bob, everyone I've talked to, says that we've got to get used to the fact that things are going to get worse. And when I do tune in the news and I try to pay attention to all this stuff, it's just mind-numbing the level of the political discussion about all these various topics that we're discussing, and it's getting really, really frustrating. That's why I kind of dropped out of mainstream politics, because I just don't want to be involved with it. It's the same old all the time. So if things are going to get worse, what's the, you know, I mean, I still fight, but how do you stay involved without becoming dispirited or becoming just wanting to just throw up your hands in absolute...
That's a damn good question.
Well, to paraphrase the late, great Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, I would never encourage anyone to use drugs or alcohol, but they've always worked for me.
Larry, here's the
thing. I went through this in the 60s. I went through the whole thing. There was a lot of guys were... I knew why I didn't favor the war in Vietnam. I just figured, first of all, as an American, there wasn't a goddamn thing in it for us to waste our people's lives. And if the people wanted whole, let them have whole. But I don't know what the hell there is to do about this stuff today, because the average American has really been sold a bill of goods. The unemployment situation, the lack of jobs, the jobs being shipped overseas. We can't say that hasn't happened. But how you deal with it, I don't know, because there also, the whole educational system was so much cheaper in the 60s.
And better.
But I guess the question is, do we have to get used to the fact that things are going to get worse for the average person and for people who are poorer than, have less resources than the average, and that things are going to get better for the top whatever,
Larry, I don't think get used to it is necessarily where our heads should be. I don't think anybody should ever feel good about the fact that the engine that drives this country is throwing a rod.
Well, Bob, as people get older, they lose their resilience and their ability to even think about trying to fight it. After a while, they just simply give up. I think that's what the other caller is trying to say.
Well, no, I think that is. But the fact of the matter, if there's any... But what I was saying is, I don't think get used to is necessarily the right term, but I think you're always in good stead if you acknowledge reality. And the reality of this country is that it is behaving as so many other empires have.
Yes.
And that is that it thinks more of its wealth class than it does of its working class and the people who actually make the country go.
Well, follow the course of history, Bob. That's the way it's always been.
Sure, whether it's Tsarist Russia, the Byzantine Empire.
Rome
itself, mm-hmm. Greece, Egypt. I think you're always in good stead if you acknowledge reality. Hey, where am I coming from? Oh.
The people
Sergi, what were you going to say? Sergi was going to say something, and I didn't ever get what he was... I mean, he was going to explain something to me.
Hold up a minute, Larry, please.
Okay.
Angry Indian's in now, Bob.
Cool.
Yes, sir.
But apparently, hey, Angry, have you? Did you fix that thing where you had the feedback coming back at me?
Yeah. What, do you still hear?
No, I don't. Hallelujah.
All right.
So welcome the Angry Indian to the group.
Yes, sir.
Hello.
All right, thank you, fellas. So I guess I go along, continue on.
Where were we?
Go ahead, Larry.
Sorry, state of the economy, so...
Well, first of all, I missed 45 minutes of the discussion, because I was taking a call. So you were talking about oil and talking about, the tar sands and talking about energy during that time, so I missed that entire discussion. When I came back on, I was asking if I have to accept and get used to the fact that things that people who are, middle class and lower are going to have to get used to the sort of small is beautiful thesis that E.F. Schumacher was talking about, while the wealthier classes are going to get wealthier and wealthier. And I know that Sergi was going to say something to me, or was going to mention something, and I didn't hear what his response was. And that's the question that I was asking.
Sergi?
Oh, sorry.
He stepped away for more pizza and Kool-Aid.
Oh.
Okay.
That was about 30 minutes ago, Don.
Oh, I'm sorry.
As far as what I was going to say to Larry, I've long forgotten that. So if it comes back to me, I'll bring it up.
All right. Well, let me just jump out there since our buddy Angry has never been part of the group. What's on your mind this evening?
Well, a few things, but since you're talking about the tar sands and fuel, has anyone brought up so far tonight what happened at LC Potog in Canada, where the Royal Canadian Mounted Police decided to swarm on? They sent about 700 national police officers to a town of a little under 900 to stop the First Nations people up there from protecting their own environment.
Is this over toward New Brunswick?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's Mi'kmaq territory. And it's an American firm from Texas that's up there doing the damage to their environment. And the conservative government there, if you're not aware of Harper or of what's happening right now with the conservatives or the Tories in Canada with their crack-smoking mayor in Toronto, they don't give a damn about indigenous people. They don't give a damn about the land. We have more than 500 indigenous women that have been that are missing. Many are worse than missing. We're not getting any sort of feedback on either side of the border. No one's really talking about this, and no one's talking about the fact that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police came down on women and children with submachine guns. They didn't be using, every technological advancement that law enforcement has been using pretty much like the military on civilian populations who were peacefully protesting. It is their territory. We keep hearing a lot about how the, and I'm not saying this disrespectfully, I'm saying this as what is. The European settlers are still, they will come up with these treaties and then violate the treaties and then say that the native people have no right to democratically stand up and defend their rights either in parliament or either on the street. So, if we're going to talk about the XL pipeline, and it's good that we're talking about the spills, it's good that we're talking about the environmental damage that's proposed to come through the middle of the United States because of this, but we also have to ask what is happening to the least of the people. We have a lot of folks, not just indigenous people, and for folks who think that this is just an indigenous issue. Well, there's a whole lot of white farmers who their land is being destroyed by these ruptures in these pipelines. There's been three derailments so far in Canada in terms of petroleum spills. This affects everybody.
Yeah, and of course, just at the beginning of the program, we were talking about this this derailment with these tanker cars down in Alabama. Mm-hmm. We're gonna and all of this is, tell me if I'm wrong, Angry, but all of this has kind of been predicted, has it not? These are all things that come with peak oil, and the slide down the downside of the backside of the peak.
Remember the story I sent you, was it last week, that showed how the environmental damage being done in Appalachia to your people has significantly reduced not just the general health, but even the cognitive, well-being
yes.
of the people who live in the region.
Yeah, and I, the 8 campaign issued a press release on that, and none of us who are doing the work were the least bit surprised by that report, Angry. Because it's soul consuming.
They don't care.
Let me just throw something out at you from here on the front lines. There's a hospital down in Huntington, West Virginia, called St. Mary's, and it is playing host soon to a meeting about. Oh, God, what is it? West Virginia's energy future or some sort of stupid bullshit like that. And lo and behold, their featured speaker is the head of the ACCCE, the American Clean Coal Coalition for whatever, the same yahoos that send me the stupid press releases periodically. And so a group of people have, begged, pleaded with St. Mary's Hospital, saying, look, here's all the science. Here are the reports, peer-reviewed studies, birth defects, heart disease, cancer, mental illness, poverty. Everything ties into the liquidation of Appalachia and its sale to the highest bidder on the global market. Please, for the love of all that's holy, in light of the fact that your name is St. Mary's, move this thing somewhere else. You don't need to be associated with it. And St. Mary's is like, screw you. And lo and behold, the dumb bastards went and got a temporary restraining order against people who were planning to picket and protest, saying, you know, you cannot use bullhorns next to patient windows. You cannot block patient access. And there was never any plan to do that in the first place. The thing is, the thing's in a St. Mary's building two blocks away from the main hospital. But there, Avery, no dissent will be brooked.
Avery, I wanted to ask where that story, where I can read about that story you were talking about, or that you were talking about now.
Go ahead, Angry.
No, which one are you talking about, sir?
The mental illness.
The story about the First Nations people in New Brunswick being...
Well, you can simply go to Halifax Media Co-op or the any of the cooperative media entities up in Canada. All you can simply follow my feed at The Angry Indian on Twitter. I mean, there's a lot of Native people that are following this. And usually the only people who tend to report this is not the mainstream news, because when the mainstream news reported it, they reported that there were Indians going berserk against the Canadian state. And that's not... Let's go.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
I got some feedback going on somewhere. Anybody?
I'm here.
It's coming from you, Bob. It's all I can see.
Mute never. Hey, Angry, could that be you?
I haven't touched anything.
Oh, wait. Okay, hold on. How very strange. It's coming over Bill's line.
What?
Yeah, well, it seems to have gone now, so we're all better.
Yeah, I had the phone down. I had to get up for a minute.
Okay.
All right, I'll just say this quick, just so we can keep going. But the crisis of the Mi'kmaq Nation up in New Brunswick, you know, again, it is very important for us as Indigenous people that this is recognized, but it does affect everybody. And anyone who really wants to get the information about that really needs to go to the alternative Native media, which I can't really come up with some addresses right now, but there's plenty out there. But what I do want to throw out, though, because Bob and I talk about this, and Bob mentions this in many ways, so does Mike Malloy mention this in a lot of ways. But no one is really asking themselves if they're preventing us from protesting and raising the issue here. What did it do to people across the world in the third and fourth worlds?
Yeah, them, Angry them, they just shoot.
Well, that's what worries me, is if you lean back too hard, they'll still shoot. And they're more apt to get away with it with the news media the way it's run today than when it was, how it was run in the 60s.
But just sir, but I want to point out one thing, though. You had the, in South Africa, you have the African National Congress. Now, this is supposed to be post-apartheid. They had the Marikina massacre not too long ago, where 30-some-odd workers who were unarmed, were protesting peacefully, were shot to death.
Yeah, these were the gold miners, right, Angry?
Yeah, they were gold miners, and they were other supportive unions that worked within that industry, within the country. And they were shot to death by the South African police. Now, this is post-apartheid. And the ANC did everything exactly that the former white minority apartheid government would have done. They denied everything. They denied responsibility. They blamed every protester that was injured, and every protester that ended up deceased because of this, and were like two steps from charging them with terrorism. So, you know, what are we really talking about here? It's not just the United States. It's just the United States may be in the lead with this, but we're talking about capitalism in general.
Sure we are. Absolutely.
That's the way it's been. And it's been that way. The people that are there, they're nastier too. That group is getting bigger and bigger. They start to, eventually they include everybody into the, you know, If you say something, they'll get you. You know, if you act out something, they'll get you.
Well, I know it may sound entirely unrelated, but consider this story coming out of Iowa. And, of course, there's the story out of Detroit as well. But consider the story coming out of Iowa. A man and his son, his teenage son, have an argument because the father will not give the son money to go buy cigarettes. So the kid throws a fit, goes out, jumps in the family van, and takes off in it. The father, in turn, calls the Ames, Iowa cops, reports the car stolen. The cops, in turn, find the vehicle, pull it over, and put 6 bullets in 19-year-old Tyler Comstock. They killed him. And, you know, this happened on the Iowa State University campus. The kid was probably terrified. He ran into a cop car, and the cop hollers, "Shut off your truck." And when the kid doesn't comply, the one cop put 6 bullets through him. Now, I mean, we could probably have an all-night discussion about whether or not, as a dad, you know, you call the cops over something like this. Sure, we can. But that's an entirely inappropriate response. But more and more, even though inappropriate, it is certainly the typical response. And then I know you wanted to talk about this, Angry, and I want to give you an opportunity out of Dearborn Heights, Michigan, Renisha McBride.
Oh, yeah. One more African is just shot down or just summarily executed by, I was trying not to jump to conclusions. That, you know, I didn't want to assume that the homeowner is Caucasian. You know, I still don't know who this person is. We don't know what this person looks like. We just have heard so far that it was an accident. You know, he accidentally blew this person's head off. And we're told to not worry about this. And she's one. I mean, look, in the United States, there's an African who was executed either by a police officer, a security guard, or some opportunistic vigilante like George Zimmerman every 28 hours. There's report on this by the grassroots, of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, EF report. It's damning. I don't know how else to look at it. It's damning.
Yeah, the woman, it was 2:30 in the morning. The woman had a car accident, and of course there's the story of Florida A&M football player a few weeks back, same story. She goes to knock on the door of a home for help after a car accident. The door isn't answered. She turns around and walks away and takes a shotgun blast to the back of the head.
Oh, jeez. Oh, God.
And for anybody who wants to think that this is somehow anomalous relative to America, you know, I say BS. This is America. I'm sure the person with the shotgun was just protecting freedom, right?
Yeah.
Kevin, you were going to say something?
Assuming the answer is no. Did they have charged the guy yet?
No charges.
And then the other comment I have. The other comment I'd have is I really believe that those who are going out and protesting, we need to begin to get more creative in our protesting. Because the protest yesterday in L.A., they just started arresting people. And
they're thinking outside the box.
Yeah, well, I mean, go ahead, Sandy.
For example, sorry to cut in there, I was talking to someone who was involved in a postal strike back in the 80s or 90s, and what they did, they were bringing the helicopters in to get past the strikers. So what the strikers did was they'd go to a local fast food joint and throw tons of food inside where the postal area was, and the seagulls would come in there, and the helicopters couldn't come in anymore.
That is creative. Just a quick follow-up to the Renisha McBride story out of Dearborn Heights. It's kind of the reverse of Trayvon Martin. You know, the cops had to be dragged kicking and screaming to file to even consider that it was criminal activity. In this case, the police requested a warrant, and the prosecuting attorney turned around and sent the request back and said it needs to be investigated further. You know, at least this country used to, Wild West or what have you, we used to have this notion that if you shoot somebody in the back, you're generally in the wrong. Didn't we?
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But this is a country where we have a man sitting on the Supreme Court in the form of Sammy Alito, who authored an opinion saying that it was okay for cops to shoot a fleeing kid in the back of the head at 30 feet away, who was presenting them with no threat whatsoever.
Well, but hey, Bob, my real question is for all these Republicans that like to argue with me online about how the Republican Party is for black people and the Democrats are trying to wipe us out, where are the Republicans who are jumping up and down about all of these cases? Where are the black Republicans jumping up and down about all these cases? Where's Rand Paul?
I'm sure that Ted Cruz would be more than happy to explain to Renisha McBride's family that stand your ground laws work for black America. Just like he mansplained to Trayvon's mama.
Oh boy.
Jesus. Well, hey guys, I hate to do it, but we got to wrap it up because our 2 hours together has come to a conclusion in what seems to me at least to feel like the blink of an eye. But thanks everybody, and I hope
one more thing, Bob.
Yeah, Jim.
And we got to remember what's coming up this weekend, this Veterans Day, and we all owe our veterans and the sacrifices they've made, and the families they've made or have made, and everyone else connected with the effort. We all owe them a debt of gratitude and respect.
Indeed. I was going to actually do that on Monday because the 11th is Monday. Absolutely right, Jim. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
But thanks, right, everybody. And just a reminder, the group will continue either this way now or at 12:05 Eastern time immediately after Malloy, right, Duncan?
Oh, it stays open most Friday nights now after you close it out.
How do you access that, Bob?
Via Skype.
We have it via Skype every Friday. Bob, I wanted to get...
Wait, Larry.
Sorry.
Forget it.
Okay.
Yeah. I got to knock off here. And good night, phone group. Good night, Skype group. Thank you all very, very much. Maybe I'll catch you in the room here in a couple of hours. It is time to get out of here. And I want to thank Ed, and I want to thank VJ, and I want to thank Sal, the three people who helped make the horn possible tonight. With their help, collectively, we managed to raise $60, and that leaves only $90 for tonight's fundraising. And then, well, anything we can do to get out of the hole, and this being the end of the week, over the weekend, whatever, however you can help, if you can help, it will be much, much appreciated. Because, well, it's the only way that this keeps going. This is entirely listener-driven radio. So thank you very kindly. And thanks to everybody who makes all this go. Thanks to Duncan there, who moderates the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Thanks to Duncan and Lottie and Texas Betsy, who moderate in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to Ben Birch. Thank you to John Fox. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT.org, ACHECT.org. Go there. Be a part of helping us end the Appalachian apocalypse. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Here comes Rick Smith on the horn.
Network.